You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines around our region this past week. Our panel today, Mike Sharp with Idaho News 6, Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com, and Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio News. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Happy Friday.
So, you guys, I think before we move into the topics of the week, I think it's important to remember and acknowledge that today is the 19th anniversary of September 11th, which took the lives that day of 2,977 people. And I'm curious because I know some of you were quite young, some of us were in the business, and I would like to hear just maybe some memories or something that stuck out to you that day. And Mike, I'll just start with you.
It's a tough one because, you know, growing up, I was in high school at the time in Caldwell. So I didn't have a direct connection. You know, I experienced it like anybody else in Idaho on television in my geometry class and then in my English class. And we all kind of watched it. I think what really stands out to me more than my experience was I had two teachers during that time who were from New York. And I remember my history teacher didn't say a word to us the entire class. He stood 3 feet away from the television and just watched and waited for phone calls and waited to hear from his family and his friends. My theater teacher was from Brooklyn and she similarly sat and watched the coverage. I remember trying to experience it through their eyes and seeing the pain, the fear of thinking that anybody in your family or anybody with whom you grew up could have been a victim in that circumstance. Mm-hmm. That's just always stuck with me more than anything that I experienced personally through that day.
Yeah. And Margaret, I know you were quite young, but I've always been curious about how, you know, as an adult now, but being a child when this happened, how it affected you, if any, or is it just something more that you've just grown up, you know, just being a part of life and hearing about rather than maybe having a direct impact that day, if that makes sense?
Well, that day really sticks out to me because of the way I learned about it. I was 7 years old. I was in second grade and we were living in the Gulf Coast, so very far away from the attacks. And my school made the decision not to tell any of the kids until we got home. So I didn't know about it. I kind of went about my day just doing regular kid stuff, I guess. And I didn't know about it until I got home and I saw my mom watching the news on television, which is something I have never seen my parents do other than that day. They were NPR listeners and newspaper readers and not television news people. And that was how I knew something was wrong, that my mom had CNN on. And I just remember knowing it was very serious because CNN stayed on for the next 2 days. And so that's, as a journalist now, I kind of think about it in terms of how I learned about it and going, oh man, it's serious if we're watching this on television.
Yeah.
And sorry, go on.
No, go ahead, Margaret.
Just wanted to say, you know, and it did kind of become a, you know, something that just, you couldn't really process at that age, that it happened. But my father was a Coast Guard service member. And so, you know, he was not directly involved in responding to the attacks that day, but he was in an agency that was and kind of was in one of those first responder type jobs. And I do remember, you know, kind of having that flickering worry as a kid being thinking, is my dad going to go up there, going to go, you know, be involved in any of this? And so really that's kind of where the worry and the anxiety was for me at that time.
Yeah. Which makes, especially being so little like that. And Heath, what about you? I mean, I know you were older than Mike and Margaret, but what sticks out to you?
Yeah. I mean, The attacks actually ended up having a pretty big impact on my life quite a few years later. But at the time I was in college, and I remember that day very distinctly. My roommate pounded on my door. I was still asleep and didn't have much information, but was basically pounding on my door saying, New York's been attacked. And we ended up, like a lot of people, just being glued to the television. And I remember, you know, there was a lot of fear, there was a lot of anger, and there really wasn't much information at the beginning. And it was a really strange time. I was on the West Coast. I went to school in California, and, but I actually grew up in New York City until I was 10 years old. So, you know, it was very surreal for me because we were very far away, but I did feel, a connection to the city. And then, you know, just a few years, well, several years later, I ended up going overseas and working in Iraq and Afghanistan. So, you know, it's very tangible to me just because I sort of covered the aftermath of those attacks. And as we know, 19 years later, that aftermath is still happening. You know, I mean, we're still in Iraq, we're still in Afghanistan. So, yeah, it's had a lot of meaning for me.
Yeah. Well, and quickly for myself, I was actually here in Boise reporting and anchoring the news and getting ready for a newscast that morning and hearing that a plane had flown into the Twin Towers. And I actually had a sister who lived in New York, and I'd actually lived in New York City just about 2 years before that, had grown up going back there, you know, visiting my older sister and everything, and just thought, oh, it must have been just a small plane hit the tower. And then all of a sudden, you know, the news started coming out. And in the midst of having to be on the air, I was also trying to get a hold of my sister because my oldest sister was still living in New York City at the time, couldn't get a hold of her. So, you know, it took about a day. She was perfectly fine. But a gentleman in her building who we both knew died in the towers that day. So yeah, it's very interesting, I think, to look back on it. And in fact, when I picked my kids up from school today, I said, did you talk about 9/11 today? And it's interesting, Margaret, you were seven. I have an 8-year-old and he's in third grade. And he said, well, no, we didn't talk about it today. And I said, well, do you know what it is? And he goes, well, yeah, it's the Twin Towers. And then my seventh grader, said, yes, we talked about it in every class. And, you know, so even the impact that it has on them and then the conversations I think that you have with this next generation about it. But on the way home, they asked me, they said, well, what was September 10th like? And then, you know, and I thought that was very interesting because you think about that, right? For those of us who remember this vividly, it was like, oh, you could walk through airports. You could do this. You could do that. So yeah, it still, I think, has effects all of these years later. So I thank you for all of your memories of it and your insights into it. Just wanted to give some acknowledgement to that day. So again, the 19th anniversary of September 11th today. There is other news going on that we need to get to, and I want to bring in our senior producer, Frankie Barnhill, for the next couple of minutes on this. The reason being is that Frankie has covered wildfires for quite a few years now here at Boise State Public Radio News, and there are wildfires raging right now, as many of you know. I think a lot of people have family members and friends along the West Coast. So, Frankie, just kind of get us updated as to where we are with these fires, because especially for the state of Oregon, there's never been fires like this.
Right, Gemma. And it's just been a really harrowing time watching our neighbors to the west this week. And we all feel for them. And yes, have members or a family or friends potentially who we've heard of who've had to evacuate or are on notice to evacuate. I want to say something just off the top, really clearly. This could be us, Idaho. It has been us in the past, and it likely will be us in the near future. You know, this is a time where wildfires, we're seeing the intensity and ramp up, and the actual fact of where they're occurring, and multiple fires burning across one state, let alone states across the West, making it that much more complicated to actually battle these fires. Also want to note, you know, wildfire is not inherently bad. It's been on the landscape for thousands of years. When it's natural, it regenerates life. But right now what we're seeing is something very different. So as of right now in Oregon, yeah, there's 15 active fires, Washington State 16, and in California there's 24. According to the National Interagency Fire Center, which is based in Boise, more than 800,000 acres burned in Oregon, about 625,000 in Washington, and more than 2.5 million in California. So the scale really is just absolutely, it's hard to fathom. Fire experts across, you know, the West are just kind of at a loss for words for what this is. We've heard of, you know, we know towns in Oregon and Washington have been completely destroyed, and not just one town, but multiple towns. And then, of course, the air quality issues and what that brings up. Want to point out, you know, there's multiple reasons for this, because it's always, okay, why is this happening? It's been years, decades of total fire suppression policy that's made this problem come to this point, along with, you know, people being careless. Most fires are ignited by people. We don't yet know where these fires, how these fires were ignited. We'll find out more soon. And then, of course, climate change. It's making the landscape hotter and drier for longer periods. And there's also the problem of poor development practices with people building their homes in what's known as the wildland-urban interface, which is, it's a dangerous place to build a home right now if you don't have the proper tools and mitigation strategies. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot going on, Gemma. Yeah.
Yeah. So Frankie, let's get back to, as you mentioned, I mean, towns that have been completely burned down. I mean, Talent and Phoenix, which are basically suburbs of Ashland. If you think of it almost like Ashland being a Boise, I mean, on a smaller scale, and then Talent and Phoenix would be similar to like a Meridian and a Nampa, and Talent and Phoenix have been decimated. And so all of these people have had to evacuate. That's bad enough, I would think, to have to evacuate. And they've had different levels, like level one, level two, and that level three is the go now level where you have to leave your home. We're in the midst of a pandemic.
Yep.
So, I mean, and so then people are going to shelters and all of that. Do we have any information as to how they're keeping, I mean, of course, people safe from the fire, but then keeping them safe when you have to now be around people that you have not been interfacing with?
Yeah, it really feels like just all of these disasters at the same time, and it's really hard to see how to get through this at this exact point. As far as you know how many cases potentially are spreading because of this, we'll just wait and see and find out more. I do want to note there's, you know, new information, new research out there that really does point to, especially for firefighters, the complications that come with the air that they're breathing, fighting these blazes while COVID is going on. Not to mention fire camps, they're not exactly conducive to social distancing and washing your hands. So we can only, you know, hope that our firefighters who are doing everything they can to keep these communities safe will be able to remain safe themselves in the middle of a pandemic. I do want to note too, there are things Idaho should do. So if you're listening to this and, you know, it feels distant, by the way, we know that our air quality is going to be affected by this weekend. Mm-hmm. Looks like there'll be smoke coming into definitely in the Treasure Valley and settling into an inversion again, potentially. But there are things people can do. I'll link on our website to some FireWise tools, things like cleaning out your gutters and your roofs and removing vegetation at the base of your house, changing the landscaping you do. For people who live in this wildland urban interface, these are all steps we can take individually. But then there's also big policy changes that could potentially be addressed too.
And Frankie, before I let you go, I mean, another thing that people can do is having a go bag ready. And also, I know that you have family that have been evacuated. I have a brother who's been evacuated, two sisters who are in that level too. And one thing that they've all done which I didn't think of before, is they went around their homes, opening all of the drawers and taking pictures, documentation of all of their possessions, because you can't take everything with you. But can you quickly talk about like what should go into a go bag? Because you're right. I mean, we have homes in the Boise area that are in the Treasure Valley, frankly, and all across Idaho that are in that urban wildland area.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, things like have some cash ready to go, have a bag. I mean, a lot of us are campers out in the West. So kind of thinking of having your camping supplies ready to go. It's always good to have a way to cook some food potentially, or some dried food that you can have in a bag to get through these tough times. You know, have some camping gear ready to take if you need to, if you can't find a shelter, or certainly during the pandemic that gets a little bit more complicated. Those are all good things to have. And yeah, I think that's a great idea to take note of your valuables and really have a plan with your family. Part of it is just talking it out with everyone, like, okay, if this happens, this is what we're going to do. This is what we'll grab. This is what we'll leave. Being able to process that with your family really helps in the case of an emergency like this.
Heath, you track all of the coronavirus numbers for Boise State Public Radio News. And Wednesday was the deadliest day that we've seen in Idaho since the pandemic.
Yeah, it was. And that might come as a surprise to people because we've been in this for so long now. I know there's a lot of fatigue going on. I guess, you know, coronavirus fatigue certainly were, I think, all pretty beaten down by what's been happening. But unfortunately, that doesn't stop the virus from continuing. And we've had, you know, a steady number of days of pretty high cases. We're usually in the 200s or even 300s. And Wednesday we had 17 deaths, and that topped the next highest, which was 14. So unfortunately, it's still going on. It's still deadly, and we still have a lot of work to do.
And Mike, I mean, then of course, what happens within this pandemic is how kids are all going back to school. Some kids are online, some kids are in a hybrid model, similar to what my kids are doing. Some kids are fully, at home and waiting to go back to school online and using online. And this brings me to the West Ada School District. They went back Tuesday, everyone completely online. And what happened?
Well, I think if you talk to any West Ada parent, you would find out that it did not go well. I think one of my favorite quotes came from the West Ada school board meeting, where it was the whole situation was deemed, quote, not ideal.
That's one way to put it.
Yeah, it's just perfect summation. So, I mean, we talked to some parents about their experience pretty much immediately from the get-go. There were issues accessing apps. There were issues logging in. There were issues. One parent told us the story of, you know, he had two kids that were trying to get their remote learning underway. He had to reboot the system within the first hour. Only one of the kids ended up getting access again so that they could continue their class. It's begged bigger questions, and it's going to have to take a lot of shoe leather reporting from our news outlet and every other news outlet on this panel and in this market to continue asking these tough questions about how school districts had 180 days to prepare, knowing that their students were likely going to be at least in a hybrid model, if not completely online. And none of these issues seem to be ironed out. I even saw a tweet yesterday from the Twitter account for Parents for School Choice, who had some choice words for West Ada School District, you know, criticizing their inability to get things together before the beginning of the school district. And that's not a criticism of the teachers and the people who are becoming low-level IT experts and trying to help. I mean, we talked the last time I was on here about the beginning of Boise schools. My own daughter is part of that, and watching her teacher have to handle
an entire class filled with first graders and technical issues and difficulty muting mics and staying on topic. I mean, in best case scenarios, it is not an easy thing. So starting from the way they did is going to make it much more difficult. And what we're seeing now is parents are kind of jumping off that ship and they're wanting to shift to that hybrid model and be part of that first group that goes back to school because the difficulty was so transparent.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then they held the school board in West Ada, or the school district board of trustees held a special session last evening, and they're apparently, they haven't voted on anything at this point. They're postponing it, but we're going to look at a revised reopening plan. And so now we're waiting to see, I guess, if some kids in West Ada potentially go back come Monday. Because I believe with Boise, Mike, they said they needed at least 2 to 3 weeks, and there's not going to be any hybrid model at least until like September 21st.
Exactly. And I think it's important to remember that all of these decisions are affecting real people, and not just the students, but also the students' parents, the students' family, maybe grandparents who watch the kids. And not having that clarity as you go into the weekend is a very frustrating thing, because people are setting work schedules and deciding when to have certain meetings or when to go into the office or how their life is going to work based on what their child is going to need from them. And so we are consistently receiving emails and messages. Pretty much every parent is frustrated, and there's not really an easy option. There's no easy answer that's going to make every parent happy. But it's going to be very difficult, I think, to kind of put all this back together, right? Get the toothpaste all back in the bottle, because balls have been dropped each step of the way. And that's, once again, that's not a criticism of even the administration officials who are dedicating their days to try to figure these things out and to try to roll out an education that is beneficial for everybody. But the truth is, this has largely been beneficial to nobody, and that has to be figured out.
Right. Well, and as Heath mentioned, I mean, Wednesday being our deadliest day, we are still in this pandemic, whether we like it or not. So the likelihood that schools, at least when you're talking the largest school district in the state, West Ada, another large school district, Boise, I mean, basically the Treasure Valley, you're not going to have kids going back fully in person. I mean, I think as parents, we have to recognize that this may be what school looks like this year.
Right. It's and who knows how long it lasts. I mean, the truth is, we currently do not have a vaccination, and that could change in November. That could change next year, depending on who you're listening to. We do not currently have a treatment. And that's another thing that people are looking for the health and safety of what be parents, teachers, or students. No matter when students go back to school, there will be spread of this virus. As Heath mentioned, we all may want to move on from it because it feels better to do that. But the truth is, the virus has not gone away, and it will continue to affect people in terrible ways. Whether that be students who could possibly bring the virus home to their parents, or students who may take the virus to school from their parents. We're still learning every single day more and more troubling things about this virus. And at some point, parents have to make a decision based on what is best for their child and the safety of their child while measuring the education that their children are getting. And it is an impossible decision on its own in best case scenarios. So I think that frustration is boiling over, because those options that are available that are a bitter pill, no matter which side you're on, there was a hope that at least they would roll out in a way that would be some sort of normalcy for the children. And instead, it has been IT issues and connectivity issues and laptops not working and kids having to connect through cell phones. And that, all of that piled onto what is already a very difficult time, has just made things boil over.
Yeah. Margaret, before we take a break, where are we in this in the recall effort for Boise Mayor Lauren McClain and City Council Member Lisa Sanchez? I mean, I do realize that it was suspended, but tell us how and why that happened.
Right. So the organizers for the recall effort had until the end of September to get their 26,000, roughly 26,000 signatures turned in for a March special election to recall City Councilmember Sanchez and Mayor McClain. They missed the deadline to turn in signatures from Ada County to get the special election on the November ballot, but they still could have done it in March. But then on Friday, late Friday, the recall organizers announced that they are suspending their campaign because they looked at the signatures and they said, okay, we're not going to be able to get what we need. And they didn't want to waste volunteers' time for another month. According to counts posted on the recall Facebook group, they only gathered between 1,200 and 1,300 signatures in, 1,000 signatures, my bad, between 12,000 and 13,000 signatures, in 60 days. And they were looking at the numbers and they just said, we cannot make this happen. And they don't know even how many of those were valid. Of the initial batch, only 7,000 they gathered were valid signatures. And then they went back and gathered more later. The group also mentioned factors like the November election overshadowing local politics. I'm not sure what they meant by that specifically. Organizers did not elaborate. Mm-hmm. And they also cited confusion related to a change.org petition that over 30,000 people had signed in support of recalling McClain. But change.org, you can sign those petitions all you want, but it doesn't do anything. It legally a change.org petition has no standing. And so they were running into confusion where people were thinking, oh yeah, I signed change.org, not an official recall signature.
And a quick warning before we go on with our next topic, we are about to talk about a mental health topic that could be triggering for some people. So if you need to take a break from your radio or skip forward a few minutes on the podcast feed, I'm going to give you a second to do that. And for anyone who is struggling, there is help in Idaho. You can call this hotline to talk with someone in the Gem State. It is 208-398-4357. Again, that number, 208-398-4357. Heath, in the break, we heard just a little bit of the story that you've been covering and the skyrocketing numbers with youth suicide by firearm.
Yeah, the numbers are really alarming, unfortunately. There was a national study of youth firearm suicide in the U.S., and the news wasn't good. Across the country, youth firearm suicide rate had actually risen by 56%. And in Idaho, it was 105%. So really kind of shocking numbers in Idaho, mm-hmm. Way above the national average. And unfortunately, it is just kind of the latest in a series of numbers like that for Idaho, which has one of the highest overall suicide rates in the country.
Do we have any reason why, any information, Heath, as to why? I mean, yes, as you mentioned, these numbers are going up across the nation, but I mean, in Idaho, do we know why? Is there anything that can point to why we're seeing such an increase?
Well, it's suicide is a complex topic. And the reasons for people attempting suicide are many and again complex. So it's not fully understood what is pushing this. And Idaho is actually not alone in the Mountain West. The whole region has much higher than average rates, unfortunately. There is one thing that does seem to have an effect, though, and that is gun ownership. States with higher gun ownership rates tend to have higher suicide rates. And you know, that is just because of the sort of brute fact that when folks use guns, it's very rare that they survive. And so gun ownership has been tied in studies to higher rates. Idaho, as I think anybody who lives here knows, has high gun ownership rates. And so that, you know, what that's doing is actually it's bringing people across a lot of political divides together, trying to get gun safety information out there for owners in a non-judgmental way. It's not a way to get into the gun debate. It's just to say, hey, if you own guns, here's some ways to safely store them, so that if someone's in a bad way, if someone's feeling impulsive, that it's hard to get to those weapons. And we probably don't have time to get into all of that, but you know, one of the basic easy ways to do that is to keep ammunition and firearms stored separately from each other.
And again, for anyone who is struggling, know that there is help here in Idaho. You can call this hotline to talk with someone. That number is 208-398-4357. Again, 208-398-4357. So Mike, here we are in the middle of a pandemic, and we know also we've talked about how schools have been affected by this, but the labor force, the labor market has been affected. Can you kind of get us updated as to what we've been seeing and what's been trending?
Right. I think a lot of times the reporting on economic issues, people just kind of move on as the recovery starts after the big headline grabbing numbers that were coming out at the beginning of this pandemic when a lot of people were jobless. What we're learning at this point is that, you know, we all know that we started at a record low unemployment, about 2.5% in March. We reached a peak at about 11.8% in April, and now we've kind of adjusted down to 5%, which is at the very least encouraging movement. It's not to the level that I think any expert would like to see, but it is progress. We're seeing progress in people who are trying to file for those unemployment claims and get help from the state, are having much better access to getting that assistance from the Department of Labor office staff, obviously because fewer numbers of people are reaching out and trying to get that help, but also because the state did involve more office staff to help with that and try to relieve some of those issues. Mm-hmm. Now we're just kind of trying to figure out when the CARES Act funding disappears, does the state then try to fund some of these measures going into the future? Do the measures then end at the end of the year? A lot of those questions are just kind of floating there, but there's at the very least positive news moving forward.
And then Margaret, speaking of employment, this is really interesting. A major downtown Boise tenant says they're not going to come back after the pandemic, at least into the physical building.
Right. CenturyLink is going to be vacating several floors of their building in downtown Boise because those workers are going to be going remote. And, you know, I think the initial thought is, well, okay, at least they're not getting laid off, you know, but there are a lot of downtown businesses and coffee shops and lunch spots that really rely on that foot traffic of, you know, workers. I'm sure we've all done it. You know, you're kind of feeling restless at your desk. You get up, you go for a walk around the block, you buy a candy bar, you come back, you know, and the fewer people working in downtown, like that's going to be a long-term hit. You know, it's the vacancy will leave 100,000 square feet of leasable space empty in downtown Boise. And that's going to be tough to fill. I don't know exactly what kind of company is going to come in. I think there's been a lot of interest in new office space in the Treasure Valley, in all of those buildings constructed by developer Tommy Ahlquist over at 10 Mile and Meridian and near Eagle Road, but that's newer spaces and stuff with more parking, probably lower rents. I don't know. It's hard to get a major company to fill multiple floors of a building like that.
Well, and what's going to be interesting too, Margaret, is we don't know if this is just a one-off or if other companies could follow suit with this. We've talked about this before on this program. I mean, all four of us right now, we all are working remotely. And, you know, when you make that adjustment, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to see if other companies follow suit, and it really will have an impact on the downtown core.
I think it's going to depend on the company. You know, I think that there are a lot of workers that want to be remote. I know I certainly really believe in being remote right now because of coronavirus. But I've also heard other companies and developers that I've spoken with have said things like, we're seeing more demand for office space because people are done working at home. They want to be back in the office with their coworkers. They want to see other human beings again. They're struggling with work-life balance where, you know, your laptop is always sitting there at the kitchen table kind of haunting you, you know, like, let me just check some emails right before I go to bed.
Right.
And not to mention the issues of balancing working at home with kids, which, you know, has been, I'm sure Mike can attest, has been a struggle. I don't know what's going to happen. I don't necessarily buy the prediction that all these companies are going to go full remote, but it wouldn't surprise me if some do.
Mm-hmm. We are out of time. I want to thank all three of you for taking time out of your day to talk with us on the Reporter Roundtable. Always enjoy it. We've been talking with Mike Sharp with Idaho News 6, Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio News, and Margaret Carmel with BoiseDev.com. Yes, Margaret has a new title. She's with BoiseDev.com, moved over from Idaho Press. Margaret, congrats on the new job.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And I'm glad I can still report on the issues in Idaho that folks care about.
Well, we're glad you're here. So thank you, all three of you. Have a great weekend.
Have a good weekend, Gemma.
Thank you.